You're listening to KBOO Portland. On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with its own challenges. So much of what defines academic success for these students is just being a successful adult.
Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th, for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Haiti, U.S. private security forces, and the big lie behind U.S. foreign policy there. And National Book Award-winning poet Martina Spanner reads from his latest collection of poetry, Jailbreak of Sparrows, and speaks out against the expanding crackdown and roundup of people of color across the USA. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. And we are happy to have you along today. And we start off, as we have done many times in the past over the last 30 years, the situation in Haiti. And joining us is our special senior correspondent, Kevin Pina, who knows more about Haiti than just about anybody in this universe, particularly about the story we're going to do right now. Welcome back, Kevin. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be here, Dennis. What a crazy, crazy story coming out of
Let me start up. We never do this, Kevin. We never do this, but let me just read a paragraph or two from the front page of yesterday's New York Times. The story is called "Hired to Fight Haiti Gangs, American Firm Loses Two Men and Rifle Cache is Stolen." Just a paragraph here. Miot Patrice Jacquet, a U.S. Navy veteran, did not hesitate to help an American military contractor with a dangerous mission in his native Haiti. The company, Studebaker Defense, had an impressive pedigree. Its board run by Wesley K. Clark, a retired American general and a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. But instead of helping wrest Haiti back from the gangs, the operation collapsed. The American team was forced to leave early. A cache of AR-15-style rifles was stolen. And 7 months ago, two people working with the team, including Mr. Jacquet, were abducted and remain missing or most likely dead. Kevin, give us some background on this story that you've been reporting for us. Is it 10 years? Is it 20 years? Is it 30 years? Take it away.
Well, let's just start with what we're piecing together now. And you have to read between the lines as you do, and you got to know who some of the players is. Now, the person that you was mentioned, who's a former Navy military officer, Jacquet, Mio Jacquet, he's the cousin of Leon Charles. And Leon Charles was the former chief of police during the 2004 coup, who worked closely with now disgraced former Senator Yuri Latour-Tour. And those gentlemen together were responsible for the campaign of repression that followed that 2004 coup. A lot of people don't know how bloody that was in the streets, but those listeners who followed this show certainly know the reports that I gave on an almost daily basis back then, highlighting the violence of the newly constituted Haitian National Police that the United States government and the so-called international community hobbled together. Leon Charles was later rewarded for his murderous reputation by becoming appointed to the U.S. Embassy under Marta Lee. Not the U.S. Embassy, excuse me, the Haitian Embassy in Washington, D.C., as the head of security for the Haitian Embassy there. Long ties with the CIA, long ties with U.S. intelligence, and this is, I can only imagine, that he was somehow involved in negotiating this on the ground for his cousin, who again was hired directly by Studebaker, Haitian American, who we now presume is dead. You know, it would be funny if it weren't tragic, but the truth is that the police, and I bring this up because the truth is that this police force, this corrupt police force, which was clearly behind the murder of this U.S. mercenary contractor working for Studebaker, behind the murder of his friend, another Haitian who was responsible for sort of the driver and fixer who took them around, who arranged their housing situation. You know, these guys were living in $10,000 a month housing, so you can imagine that they were living really well. They had, you know, armored vehicles, BMWs. They had AR-15s, as you brought up, a large stash of those. Well, it turns out that the Haitian police stole those weapons and murdered them, both of them. And nobody's surprised in Haiti because this is the same Haitian police that is the result of that coup in 2004, is the result of U.S. foreign policy that was trained by the U.S., that was vetted by the U.S., that today is in collusion with the gangs. We know this. And so it's not surprising to a lot of people in Haiti tonight that this is the outcome, unfortunately. Now, what's really going on here is that the Haitian police can no longer be trusted to do their job. Normal Rameau, who is the chief of police, was implicated in the Manzanares drug affair in 2015 that implicated former President Michel Martelly, as well as Barbecue, Jimmy Cherizaire, who is currently one of the main leaders of the so-called Vivre Ensemble gang coalition, terrorist death squad gang coalition. So there is a nexus that connects these people, and that nexus really is Michel Martelly and the PHTK party. Now, these are desperate times. The Kony government, you remember that Gary Kony was prime minister before the current prime minister, Didier Fils-Aimé. Kony hired Studebaker out of desperation, largely because he was clear you couldn't trust the police to even protect some of the members of the government. We know, of course, now they brought in Eric Prince and his new security company. They're on the ground there, have replaced Studebaker since. But my point is that the fact that this creature, the Haitian National Police, is not trustworthy has led the Haitian government to have to rely upon U.S. mercenary contractors in order to provide security for their people, but also to help to formulate an independent strategy to try to dismantle the network of Vivre Ensemble. In both cases, it's failing miserably, and largely it's failing miserably because it is built upon, rather than cooperating with the people who've been displaced in those communities, who've been the victims of those attacks by the gangs, and many times are still victims of police brutality, they simply don't trust their own people because they know that the situation has gotten to the point where the majority of Haitians are very, very desperate. And we're seeing volatility and hearing the possibility of an uprising where we had not heard it in the previous 2 years. But now it's looking increasingly clear that the government, the United States, and the Haitian police are all afraid of the masses of Haiti and what's about to come if this situation is not resolved very soon. And this is just another indication that they're incapable of solving
it. And let's be clear. Let's be clear. The Haitian people did have a peaceful uprising. They did choose a leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, but the United States of America could not stand that the Haitian people did believe in self-determination. We were there on the ground. You were there on the ground. You watched all of this unfolding. We even broke a story about how a drug czar who was trying to contain the traffickers there was fearing for his life, and nobody would listen to him.
Absolutely. There's so many convolutions and overlap and cross purposes, even within the U.S. foreign policy and intelligence community. And then, of course, you add on top of that the Canadians, and you add the French in there, and then the so-called core group, but largely led by the United States. And, of course, in the background of all this, we know that the cocaine trafficking continues, right? We know that the president of Colombia, Petro, has shown that there's still cocaine coming up through Catatumbo to Haiti's southern shores that then is being meted out to smaller planes that are ferrying it across various areas of the Caribbean and to the United States. And we also know that the United Nations has admitted that Bansam terrorist network has been extorting nearly $100 million a year for containers and shipping from companies. Now, you don't take that kind of money. If we put the billions of dollars of cocaine money and you add that to the hundreds of millions of dollars that these gangs are apparently amassing, you don't hide that under your bed, Dennis. You don't bury that kind of cash in the ground. So that means that there is somehow a network of banking, and there is a network that is getting that money out of the country that is being aided and abetted at higher levels. It's just impossible for that not to be going on in the background. Where do you put that amount of money? You know, you don't sleep with it to the house. So there's a lot more to this story. There's a lot of money changing hands. You know, people like to call Haiti one of the poorest in the Caribbean or in the world, and the truth is Haiti's not poor. It's that the majority of the people have been forced to live in poverty in order to enrich and engorge a few companies and a few individuals who have largely been on the payroll of U.S. intelligence agencies and or have been allowed to enrich themselves at the expense of their own people by the U.S. Embassy and U.S. foreign policy. And that's the real tragedy in this. Now, I also have to say, there are some honest elements in the Haitian police. You know, it's not I would say it's probably 60-70% corrupt, but there's a 30 to, you know, there's a good chunk of honest folks that I've been in touch with, you know, police commissioners who have tried to work with local populations in those neighborhoods to build what they call self-defense committees, self-defense brigades, that have been taking back their neighborhoods, that have been forcing Bansam to step back because they can't come back in again once those self-defense brigades are actually armed and trained. Now, there's been some problems with them. Yeah, there's not been enough support for that kind of strategy, which has proven successful. But largely, it's been condemned by the United Nations. It's been condemned by the international community because they say, well, if you're going to arm the population, well, then it's just another big problem because then they just become the new gangs. Well, that's not true. People want to go back home. You remember, there's more, almost 2 million people who are out of the capital, forced out by these gang attacks, by the attacks of Bansam, but there's still nearly 1.5 million people still living in those areas controlled by them. And they are sick and tired of having to pay gangs 3 or 4 times just to go grocery shopping. Toll booths, right? And you walk down the street And there's a gang toll booth. You got to pay. So, and you know who's really paying for it? Of course, their loved ones and their friends and family who are sending them money to survive under these awful conditions. It's causing not only tremendous stress within Haiti and the fabric of life and communities there, but it's also causing tremendous grief and stress for their families and loved ones in the diaspora who are helping to keep them alive. Now, the strategy of the self-defense brigades, back to that real quick, if I may, it has proven to be effective. But again, it means trusting and arming the communities to defend themselves while the police then are freed up to free the next neighborhood, inviting back those people displaced in that neighborhood, forming a new self-defense committee until you begin to take back the capital, the way that it was lost, that it was taken over by Vivian Sam, community by community, block by block. They don't trust their own people with those guns, even though what they've been told by those community leaders, hey, look, you let us defend ourselves, you arm us, you train us, we're not going to commit human rights violations, we're just merely going to hold our blocks while you guys go take over the next block. You give us the training, give us the arms, we can take care of it, and then when this thing is over, then we'll disarm. And then you can give us money and give us jobs, because you can take the same self-defense brigades, take our guns, and then just make us work brigades, and let's rebuild the Capitol. And of course, that makes perfect sense, which is why it's not being done. Because that would mean it would interrupt the channel of corruption, it would interrupt the kinds of incidents that we're hearing about that's coming out of these private military contractors and the role that they're playing on the ground. Because remember, there's big money here, Dennis, that's changing hands. It's stuff, right. And you know, where's the money coming from? Right?
Well, there's a lot to talk about. We're gonna come back to this, Kevin. But for me, the image that stands out in my mind that sort of tells the whole story, I believe it was the 2004 leap year coup where Jean-Bertrand Aristide was kidnapped, and when the Marines occupied, they moved into the medical college and the medical school that the Aristides had created for the people of Haiti. So instead of having doctors in, they had Marines in the doctor's hospital. It blows my mind. Final comment.
Well, there's plenty of symbolism to show the failure of U.S. foreign policy and the culpability and responsibility that U.S. foreign policy historically has for having created the conditions that have led us to the situation today. People ask, well, what do you think of the future? I think that ultimately, it's not if but when, I've said this before, there will be a reckoning, and it's going to come. We don't know how it's going to come, but it usually comes in a very fast way, in a very surprising way. But it's going to come, and it's going to involve the masses of the Haitian people demanding real change and taking the reins of their democracy back for the future of themselves and their children. It's going to come, Dennis.
Beautiful. Senior producer Kevin Pina covering Haiti for us for decades. And we're glad to still have you, Kevin, covering the story. I know you're in communication with many folks every day, hearing the stories daily of the suffering. So obviously this was no surprise to you. Thanks for doing all this great work for us. We'll be back to you soon, Kev. All right, take care. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now we have an extraordinary treat. We're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to come back with the National Book Award winning poet, amazing essayist, Martina Spada. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. You are in for a treat. We are always delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Martina Spada. I could actually spend the rest of the time just reading his resume, which is amazing. But just let me give you a little taste. The Spada's books of poetry include most recently Jailbreak of Sparrows, also a Mayan astronomer in Hell's Kitchen, Alabanza, New and Selected Poems, The Republic of Poetry, The Trouble Ball, Meaning of the Meaning of the Shovel, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed, and it goes on. He's written essays, powerful books of essays, and he's championed poetry and really fought as an attorney as well as a poet for human rights for all people. Martina Spada, it is great to have you back with us. I can't think of a better time to have you. So I guess you've been seeing things going on that you might find a little bit troubling. It seems like all the work of civil rights and human rights are at least temporarily being undermined.
Well, first of all, thank you, Dennis, for having me back on the program. And you're absolutely right. I look at what's happening in this country today, and there are times when I feel like my life's work as a writer and activist is being undermined, being erased. I think of my father, who himself was an activist, a leader of the Puerto Rican community, and a documentary photographer, Frank Espada. And what he might say, were he still alive, and was seeing his life's work washed away. We can't give in to that sense of despair, of course, but it's very important to acknowledge that deep down, that's how it feels right now.
Well, and we're glad that at least your work has been acknowledged, and so we have you. We should mention that you were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. You're a winner of the National Book Award. And again, as an attorney, you've been fighting the good fight. So I want to turn it over to you to share a little bit of the extraordinary poetry, because it clearly reflects your struggle. So take it away.
Well, thank you, Dennis. I want to read a few poems from my new book, Jailbreak of Sparrows, from Knopf. And it seems fitting to begin here with a poem called Snake Donald Trump. Now, at his Save America rallies, Trump would read a, quote, poem. Actually, the lyrics of the song called The Snake, written and recorded by jazz singer Oscar Brown Jr. Back in 1963. Now, he based the snake on Aesop's fable, The Farmer and the Viper, but Trump used it to demonize immigrants, not surprisingly. Meanwhile, while all that was going on, a Department of Labor investigation of underage immigrant labor on the cleaning crews of slaughterhouses revealed more than 100 such cases in 8 states. Of course, there were many more in reality. So this gave rise to the first poem I want to read tonight, and it's called The Snake. At the Save America rallies, after the damnation of the criminal aliens breaking across our borders and 1,900% more murders, he would ask the crowds if he could read a poem. This has to do with immigration, he'd say. The crowds would whoop and yip. He would read The Snake, words stolen from a song from the hand of a dead black singer who could not snatch it back, a jazz fable spun on vinyl, a tale from the fabulous of Greece centuries before Christ. The crowds would listen to the poem. Bikers for Trump, cops for Trump, Uncle Sam in his beard, the Statue of Liberty in her crown, the millionaire who sells pillows on TV.
They would testify in T-shirts that said, "Jesus is my savior, Trump is my president." They would hoist the stars and bars or signs that rhymed Trump 24 or before. They would see the movie of the poem in their heads. The snake frozen on the road. The woman scooping him up tight to nurse him with milk and honey by the fire. The incandescence of his skin brought back to life. The woman's kiss and the viper's venomous bite. Her question, why? Then the words oozing from his tongue. "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." The crowds would howl at the moral, at the punchline, at the tender woman who would die of tenderness. Like a preacher spelling out the lesson of a parable, their president would repeat, "Immigration." As they slept, the bikers and the cops, Uncle Sam and the Statue of Liberty, the millionaire on his magic pillow, adolescents from Guatemala scalded the killing floors at the slaughterhouse in Grand Island, Nebraska. Their hoses like snakes, spewing rivers that bubbled in the steam. Around them, the blades of skull splitters and bone saws waited for their fingers to slip, fangs lurking in the murk of early morning, in the days behind the goggles on the faces of adolescents from Guatemala, sleeping the next day at Walnut Middle School, shaken awake by teachers who spotted the acid burns on their hands.
Yeah, you can just continue, Martin. I mean, the poetry that you give to us gives a special meaning to the kinds of politics that we're now experiencing, and also how to transcend the horrors that are perpetrated upon communities that do the hardest work in this country and are only brutalized, and more now than ever, as we see expanding sort of fascist police forces doing sweeps around the country.
Yes, it is extraordinary how often we hear people defend this secret police force as they round up people right off the streets in the name of the law. And you don't have to go to Fox News for that kind of rationalization. All you have to do is read the New York Times, an article about what's happening right now in this country to immigrants, and go to the comments section. You'll see people piously invoking the law. It's extraordinary because this is the most lawless administration in memory, an administration that has absolutely no respect for due process, and therefore no respect for what we think of as the law. I find this particularly ironic because that is my background. I am trained as an attorney. I got my law degree from Northeastern University in Boston. I practiced law for a number of years, first in the field of bilingual education and later in the field of housing law, always in the Latino community of Greater Boston, in particular a community called Chelsea. Now, that's not the Chelsea in New York, as some of you may have heard of. It's Chelsea, Massachusetts. That's a small city right across the Tobin Bridge from Boston. It's a gateway city, a city of immigrants, always has been. And so I ended up working for a program called Su Clínica Legal. Su Clínica Legal was a legal services program for low-income Spanish-speaking tenants in Chelsea. And our clients came from expected places, but also unexpected places. They came from Puerto Rico. They came from the Dominican Republic. And they were coming in the late 1980s from someplace new. They were coming from Central America. They were coming from Guatemala. They were coming from El Salvador. They were fleeing Reagan's wars. And yes, they were undocumented. So, technically, we were not supposed to represent them. And yet, we did. So, there's a poem in my new book all about this struggle. And it's called, He Could Sing, But He Couldn't Fly. We heard about the memo. Legal aid lawyers had to ask for papers, a green card, policing what the law called illegal aliens, as if they had antenna sprouting from their heads and searching the air, sputtering in tongues from another planet, choking on oxygen. This would account for their coughing, not the oil tanks empty of oil. Now, if the tenant says, I have no papers, say, oh, I'm very sorry, in Spanish. Now, if the landlord heaves the clothes out the window, jabbering about rent like a parakeet startled by a cat, if he sneaks into the bedroom at night and wheezes like a lovesick vampire, say, ay, señora, lo siento mucho. Swing open the door of the office and point to the courthouse down the street. When the boss would ask, does she have papers? The lawyer who lied his way out of a date with the firing squad on a hill of skulls in Chile would smile, creasing his unshaven face as if to say, here's a piñata you'll never break with that stick. When the boss would ask, does she have papers? I became a wise guy pugilist, two-ton Tony Galento in the movies after the canary who sang to the cops dropped from a rooftop. He could sing, but he couldn't fly. Years before, two-ton Tony, the brawler who trained on beer and sausage, spoke his wise guy wisdom on songbirds in the movies. The newspaper boy sang of Abe Relis, Kid Twist, so called for his dexterity with an ice pick in the ear. The night before Kid Twist would testify against Anastasia and La Cosa Nostra, he plunged from the window of the Half Moon Hotel in Coney Island as half a dozen detectives played cards and saw nothing. The headlines called him the canary who could sing but couldn't fly. I was no Kid Twist. I knew my mother's stories of gangsters and revelation, informers and crucifixion in Brooklyn. I would not twist the ice pick or drop it to sing of illegal aliens, skin somehow green as the invaders on the screen of my first color TV. There was Spanish in my ear, telling me of boys in green uniforms who juggled green mangoes with bodies beheaded at their feet. There was testimonio in my ear, telling me of flight over mountains and deserts to be here at last, here in the land of ice, spreading across windows like white lace curtains. They could fly, but they couldn't sing.
We're listening to Martina Spada, National Book Award-winning poet, reading poetry. Martina is also an attorney. He's the author of many books, including Floaters, which was the winner of the National Book Award. Martina, where do you see us now? Are you concerned that we really could make that final turn to fascism? We're very close. We're on the border. And Trump is creating, expanding a national police force that he means to set out on brown and black people and people who have less in this country. Where are we? And do you want to maybe share a little bit from the book that won the National Book Award?
Sure. Let me first address your question, and then I'll I'll read a poem from Ploters. In fact, I think it would be appropriate to read the title poem. I think this is going to get much worse. And I think that's very difficult for our imaginations to absorb. I think this is going to get much worse. I think that the shock troops that Trump is sending out now into the streets to round up our friends and neighbors, to round up people who have been productive members of the community for many years, it's only the beginning. This is just a test, as they used to say years and years ago. And it's not just a test to see whether or not Trump can terrorize a certain segment of the community. It's clear that he can. It's also a test to see how the rest of us will react. Mass deportation depends on mass collaboration. Mass deportation depends on mass collaboration. Collaboration, or the refusal to collaborate, was actually the subject of the last poem I read. Right? Because this is nothing new, and neither is resistance to it. But we are all being tested right now. How are we going to react to this terror? How are we going to react to men in masks smashing windows of cars and dragging people out of them and disappearing them, sending them to countries they've never seen before, sending them to maximum security super prisons in countries like El Salvador? What are the rest of us going to do? I think that's every bit as important as ICE and the roundups themselves. Will we pass this test? I wish I knew the answer to that question. All I know is this, that the Trump administration, in spite of the ugliness now being perpetrated in the streets of this nation, still has substantial public support. That, to me, is every bit as frightening as the roundups themselves, those who cheer them on. And that, to me, is the key to whether or not we descend into some kind of neo-fascistic state. What is our tolerance as a society for the brutalization of people who cannot fight back? Yeah. And so far I don't think we're passing that test as a society. You know, there are too many people who still think that this so-called president of ours walks on the proverbial water. Now, I think it's equally important when we talk about the brutality of this government and the direction this government may take us in, to step back and assert the humanity of the immigrants among us. I think we have to remind people that human beings are more important than any border they might cross. I remember vividly an example pointed out to me years and years ago by a border activist. We were sitting in his car right on the border, and this activist pointed to his right, and he said, "What's that?" He was pointing to some bushes. I said, well, those are bushes. And he said, "That's the United States of America." Then he pointed to his left. He said, "What's that?" and I saw more bushes. I said, "Bushes?" He said, "That is Mexico." And he was making the point that national borders are fictional. The border is a fiction. It's an imaginary line. You can put up a wall. You can put up barbed wire. You can patrol back and forth with your armed guards. But at the end of the day, a border, any national border, is a fiction. It's an imaginary line. It's moved before, it will move again. And the human beings that cross that border back and forth are more important than any imaginary line. So we have to come back to the notion, the simple notion that is being forgotten every single day in this country, that migrants are human beings, and that humanity is more important than any border or any law. This brings me then to a poem I'm going to read. I think you may have had this poem in mind when you asked me to read from Floaters, the title poem of that book. June 2019, two Salvadoran migrants, father and daughter, who came to be known by their first names simply as Oscar and Valeria, drowned crossing the Rio Grande. A photograph of their bodies went viral, sparking outrage, sparking grief, but also sparking skepticism. There was a post in the I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group charging that this photograph was a fake, doctored. My poem, the title poem of my book, speaks to this photograph and to these charges. Floaters takes its title, a term used by many members of the Border Patrol to describe those who drown crossing over. And so, we come to Floaters, which has an epigraph. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask, have y'all ever seen floaters this clean? I'm not trying to be an ass, but I have never seen floaters like this. Could this be another edited photo? We've all seen the Dems and liberal parties do some pretty sick things. Anonymous post, I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group. Like a beer bottle thrown into the river by a boy too drunk to cry. Like the shard of a styrofoam cup drained of coffee, brown as the river. Like the plank of a fishing boat broken in half by the river, the dead float. And the dead have a name. Floaters, say the men of the Border Patrol, keeping watch all night by the river, hearts pumping coffee as they say the word floaters, soft as a bubble, hard as a shoe, as it nudges the body to see if it breathes, to see if it moans, to see if it sits up and speaks. And the dead have names, a feast day parade of names, names that dress all in red, names that twirl skirts, names that blow whistles, names that shake rattles, names that sing in praise of the saints. Say, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say, Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. See how they rise off the tongue, a calling of bird to bird somewhere in the trees above our heads, trilling in the dark heart of the leaves. Say what we know of them now they are dead. Oscar slapped dough for pizza with oven, blistered fingers. Daughter Valeria sang, banging a toy guitar. He slipped free of the apron he wore in the blast of the oven, sold the motorcycle he would kick till it sputtered to life, counted off pesos for the journey across the river, and the last of his 25 years, and the last of her 23 months. There is another name that beats its wings in the heart of the trees. Say, Tanya, Vanessa, Avalos, Oscar's wife, and Valeria's mother, the witness stumbling along the river. Now, their names rise off her tongue. Say, Oscar y Valeria. He swam from Matamoros across to Brownsville. The girl slung around his neck, stood her in the weeds on the Texas side of the river, swore to return with her mother in hand, turning his back as fathers do, who later say, I turned around and she was gone. In the time it takes for a bird to hop from branch to branch, Valeria jumped in the river after her father. Maybe he called out her name as he swept her up from the river. Maybe the river drowned out his voice as the water swept him away. Tanya called out the names of the saints, but the saints drowsed in the stupor of birds in the dark, their cages covered with blankets. The men in patrol would never hear their pleas for asylum, watching for floaters, hearts pumping coffee all night on the Texas side of the river. No one, they say, had ever seen floaters this clean. Oscar's black shirt yanked up to the armpits. Valeria's arm slung around her father's neck. Even after the light left her eyes, both face down in the weeds back on the Mexican side of the river. Another edited photo. See how her head disappears in his shirt, the waterlogged diaper bunched in her pants, the blue of the blue cans. The radio warned us about the crisis actors we see at one school shooting after another. The man called Oscar will breathe, sit up, speak, tug the black shirt over his head, shower off the mud, and shake hands with the photographer. Yet, the floaters did not float down the Rio Grande like Olympians showing off the backstroke, nor did their souls float up to Dallas, land of rumored jobs and a president shot in the head as he waved from his motorcade. No bubbles rose in their breath in the mud, light as the iridescent circles of soap that would fascinate a 2-year-old. And the dead still have names. Names that sing in praise of the saints, names that flower in blossoms of white, a cortege of names dressed all in black, trailing the coffins to the cemetery. Carve their names in headlines and gravestones they would never know in the kitchens of this cacophonous world. Enter their names in the book of names. Say, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say, Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. Bury them in a corner of the cemetery named for the sainted Archbishop of the Poor, shot in the heart saying mass, bullets bought by the taxes I paid when I worked as a bouncer and fractured my hand 40 years ago, and bumper stickers read, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. When the last bubble of breath escapes the body, may the men who speak of floaters, who have never seen floaters this clean, float through the clouds to the heavens, where they paddle the air as they wait for the saint who flips through the keys in his ring like a drowsy janitor till he fingers the key that turns the lock and shuts the gate on their babble-tongued faces, and they plunge back to earth, a shower of hailstones pelting the river. The Mexican side of the river.
Wow. Floaters from the title poem from the book Floaters, published, I believe, in 2021, winner of the National Book Award for Poetry. The author is Martina Spada, and we are graced with his presence from time to time. And I love poetry. You remind me, Martine, why I love poetry so much. Because there are many ways to bring information to the people. information that maybe transcends the shallow and gives us a real sense of what happened, what's wrong, and perhaps how to change it. I keep remembering this these aphorisms from this this carpenter who fled the Nazis in Europe to end up with the Nazis in Argentina, Antonio Porquia, and he had this saying that said, "Truth has very few friends, and those few are suicides." But you are a truth teller, Martine, and it's a correction. And we need this language, and we thank you for that. And we have a few minutes left, and I want to give it to you to do whatever you want. We have about 8 minutes.
Okay, so if we have 8 minutes, this is how I'd like to finish. I want to read a poem about something that happened right there in the city of Alameda. There is a historic association between Latino males and the perception of dangerousness, whether it's criminal dangerousness or revolutionary dangerousness. And this brings me to Mario Gonzalez Arenales from Oakland, who died after being pinned face down for 5 minutes by three Alameda police officers on April the 19th, 2021. An independent autopsy found, in fact, that he died from, quote, restraint asphyxiation. Body cam video showed that Gonzalez was not armed, nor verbally or physically threatening, and one officer kept a knee in his upper back till he became unresponsive. And ironically enough, this homicide occurred on exactly the same day jury deliberations began in the trial of Officer Derek Chauvin, who, of course, pinned George Floyd down with a knee to the neck for more than 9 minutes in May of 2020 and was convicted of murder in Minneapolis. So this poem of mine is called Wake Up Mario, from Mario Gonzalez Arenales, 1994 to 2021. Epigraph. He's not doing anything wrong. He's just scaring my wife. Call to the Alameda Police Department, April 19, 2021. They watched him from the window of the house, a man at the fence in a crooked wool cap, chipping at their tree with a comb, liquor bottles and a shopping basket by his feet. They heard him speak to the wife's mother in the yard, tongue thick in his mouth, heavy with lamentation. He could be the Aztec god of pestilence, no mask breathing the plague on them through walls and doors. The Mexican nanny might be able to read the hieroglyphics tumbling from his mouth, but she was wheeling a stroller through the streets of Alameda, the trees bowing deeply. On the news, the body cam clip wobbles like the video at a barbecue. The cops are cheerful as they encircle him in the park across the street. He says his name is Mario. One cop scolds this refugee from Oakland about drinking in our parks, wants ID so they can be on our merry way. Mario says, "Merry go round." He steps up on a tree stump as if to ride it. The cops climb off the spinning horses of Mario's imagination, tugging at his arms as he peeks at them under the cap. Now, there are cowboys at the rodeo, but Mario is not a steer, crashing to the applause of hands who would carve him into steaks. The cops shove him to the ground, face down. Mario squirms and bucks. He is the prize at the county fair, a beast who tries to calm his captors, so he spits all the words he knows to make them stop. Oh, God, please, thank you, and sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. I forgive you, says one cop as the other cop digs his knee into Mario's back, where it stays even after they cuff him, even after the first cop says, think we can roll him on his side? He asks Mario for his birthday, as if there will be a barbecue in the backyard at the cop's house, and Mario, face down in the wood chips and the dirt, with the other cop's knee pressing into his back, wheezes the word, 1994. There were cries, then silence. There were no last words. In medieval days, the prisoner at the block would forgive the headsman and drop a coin into his hand for a clean strike of the blade. In Salem's Puritan days, a man accused of witchcraft, after 2 days of stone stacked on him, sneered, "More weight." There were no last words from Mario when they rolled him over at last. The last words were in the headlines that same day. Jury deliberations 2,000 miles away in Minneapolis. The case of a cop kneeling on the neck of a black man, face down and handcuffed for 9 minutes. In Alameda, the cops began CPR and their incantation over the asphyxiated body. "Wake up, Mario, wake up." As if he would be late for school on class picture day. As if he would miss his shift at the pizzeria where the paychecks dwindled away. As if he had an autistic brother waiting at home for Mario to help him step from the shower, button his shirt, comb his hair. His autistic brother still waits for Mario. The man who called the cops, his wife's hand gripping his shoulder, says, "We greatly regret what happened and never intended." Says, "Terrible things are being said about us." Says, "Our autistic child is able to read and is terribly sensitive." The sign in front of the dark house says, "For sale." The merry-go-round in Mario's imagination grinds on, creaking day after day. The caller who presses the button to make the horses go. The cops charging like cavalry after the renegade. The dead man galloping ahead, escape impossible. His horse impaled on a pole, kicking the air. The Mexican nanny, called Crucita, blames herself for rolling the stroller back too late. She visits the altar for Mario across the street from the tree, missing a sliver of bark from his comb. The roses wreathing his face shrivel to plastic, balloons gone flat, votive candles cold. There is an autopsy after the autopsy. The coroner keeps the city's secrets, a priest hiding in the confessional. In her sleep, Crucita sees Mario. Sometimes a body splayed across the street, breath squeezed from his lungs like the last note from the pipes of a calliope. Sometimes breaking free, the painted horse lunging away as he rides along the coast to the deserts of Baja California, down mountain trails, off the maps of Yankee generals and their armies, deep into the songs about bandidos too clever to be caught, revolutionaries the bullets cannot kill.
Martin Espada on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Martin, we are out of time, but we are eternally grateful for your presence, your work, and we hope you'll come back and bless us again. Thank you. Gracias. Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.